speak of the waterfront? No, I'm not going to. I wish I knew the answer. I'll try my best. First, before we try to figure out what Lagmar is about, it's supposed to be a share of halacha, principally, so let us first take a look at the halachas of Lagmar. Now, as we know nowadays, which wasn't so well known 50 years ago, but despite the fact that it's in the Shulchan Aruch, but in common practice, the Sfardim and the Ashkenazim have two different practices. The Sfardim don't have Lag BaOmer, they have Lamed Dalet BaOmer, the real Sfardim. And we have Lag BaOmer. Oh, yeah, so Cheshbon had to count the days exactly, fine. So the Shailas that we have, even if they would conceptually agree with us, are not relevant to them. We have, which were probably common with them, Lag BaOmer, Lamed Dalet BaOmer. So it's a day that has some elements of Simcha to it. There are elements of Simcha. B'horai, we don't say Tachna. Right? We don't recite the Kel Mole on that day. The B'achronim cite the fact that there was some Godel and early Adoris that fasted on that day, and he was Nenash. The Rabbeinu Shel Olam slapped him up, slapped his wrist. He did not...
How can we know that?
What? Listen, I'm not a holy man to know how holy people know things. Holy people know things. I don't know how to know it. Chaim Kanievsky writes, he says, K'dole Olam know things. He cites a Tosis in Erevin. They don't even know themselves why and how they know it. But they don't. He says, one day, he says, we lived together in one house with the Chazon Ish when I was a child. My mother was the Chazon Ish's sister. And one day the Chazon Ish went to my mother and told her to keep my sister home from school today, not to send them to school. Her brother told her, so she listened to him. He says, on the way, the bus that they take to school, which they would have been on, was passing, I think, whatever, through Tel Aviv or whatever it was, and there was a terrorist incident, and the bus was blown up. He says, they would have been killed if they were on the bus. He says, that the Chazanish? I can't tell you how the Chazanish. The Chazanish, you know, how the Olam know things, you know. It's beyond our scope to, he writes, to understand. So, you know, there are elements of Simcha to it. Now, that's a very puzzling thing. But, okay, we have, you know, we have varied minhogim of Sfiras HaOmer. We're talking the Avelus of Sfiras HaOmer. Whether we count the first 33 days, whether we have 33 other days, and there are probably at least 6-7 menhagim exactly, different menhagim and how the spheres carried out. So within what we call the first minhag, there are apparently two schools of thought. One school of thought says that it represents the 33 days in which the Talmid of Rabbi Akiva actually died. Now we don't really know clearly, because the Gemara just says Kula Meiso Mei Pesach Varatzeres, in between Pesach and Shavuos, but when exactly, Shas doesn't tell us. So that's a little bit great. Some, I think, even interpret the first minhag in similar in style to the second minhag, that there were 33 days in which they died. Now the second minhag apparently chose 33 days and a little bit randomly, not saying that these are the days. But apparently they didn't want to have Avelis and Nisan. So they pushed it to Rosh Chodesh Iyar, and that's it. And they started the 33 days in Iyar. That's what seems is the pshat in minhag number two. So the 33 days don't represent any particular 33 days. There were 33 days that were chosen to mark the 33 days of the Dima of the deaths of the Talmid of Rabbi Akiva. Now, in minhag number two, it's obvious that what's the significance of Lag BaOmer is problematic. This was in the middle. We have no claim even. We don't even claim that the Talmid of Rabbi Akiva stopped dying at that point in time. So what's this celebration in the middle of all of these dark days of the Sfiras HaOmer? So there are those that suggest that we will have to, one of the things is that the Chachmei Kabbalah tell us that Shimon Rebbe based in the Zohar, Shimon Bar Yochai died on this day. And he made a very curious statement, a statement from our standpoint, which is curious. But I guess when you see with such clarity, it's not so curious. He told his Talmidim, don't mourn on my yahrzeit, celebrate. And the notion of it is that the Neshama goes to a higher place in Gan Eden each year on the yahrzeit. So for Leilot, you know, B'Kitzadik L'Kshom and Yochai, celebrate. It's good. It's a good thing. It's nothing to, you know, don't be despondent. So apparently, based on that, there's some element, because he calls for celebration, that there's some element of celebration to it. But you know, how about according to the first minhag? Now the first minhag, so we might say, well, the Talmid Rabbi Akiva stopped dying. But let's analyze that for a moment, exactly what took place. Did all the Talmid Rabbi Akiva die or not? If we do assume that all this Talmidim died, then there's certainly no cause for celebration on Lag BaOmer. All that happened, there was nobody left to die. So what do you mean, Poskim Bilobos? That's it, they finished dying off. This is not a day of to know, oh, they stopped dying on this day. Yeah, there was nobody left to die. So, Elamai. So, we're going to assume that there was some Talmidim left. But the ones that died, finished dying. Okay. So we'll have to come back first to revisit the Gemara. But even that would be puzzling. Even if that, let's say that's the case. But still, why are we celebrating? What's there to celebrate about? We have a principle which is really enshrined in the halacha. We find that it's reflected in a minhag in Hilchos Tisha B'Av, but it's enshrined in the halacha. On Motzei Tisha B'Av, according to the Din, the Gemara in Tainus debates if Shor Shechal Bo Tisha B'Av goes all the way to the end of that week or not. The Gemara paskins that it ends with Tisha B'Av. Once Tisha B'Av is over, it's finished, the mind day, that the rest of that week is free, and scot-free. So it should be that Motzei Tisha B'Av, I can sit down and grill a steak, and sit down with a steak and a bottle of wine and barrel, and we'll have a nice dinner together. Tzaradin. Come to gain the Shulchan Aruch and Simatovkov Nun Chaz and says, no way. We're a minute from Klal Yisrael that we don't eat Bosser and drink wine on Motzei Tisha B'Av. Why? Mibnei Evloi Shalyayim. Because of the morning of the day. Poshut, what it means is, if you go to a person that's sitting Shiva, Lo Aleinu, and this morning you got up from Shiva. So you went to Shachris, he got up from Shiva, that's it. The Avelim stood up, so he stood up and the Shiva is over. So he says, oh, by the way, I'm inviting you. We're having a barbecue tonight. So suppose even for the moment there wouldn't be a din shleishim and there wouldn't be a din of Yud Beis Chodesh. Forget that. Let's say the halacha just articulated a avelus of 7 days. You would think the guy blew his mind. You're just sitting shiva for a close relative. Now you're getting up and you're inviting you to be partying tonight. You blow your brains out? Would you blame him? What happened? The short circuit? And you talk, and that's even really the notion that's behind the Shloshim and the Yud Beis Chodesh too. That you just don't get up from a velus and just walk away. Goodbye. Nothing happened. Something happened. That's what they ever show you. If you really mourned in the daytime, then you're not celebrating tonight. There's a feeling which remains after the intensity of the evil of Tisha B'Av. So good, Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim stopped dying today. Okay, so to Baruch Hashem, so for tomorrow, the Chevra Kadisha doesn't have another Levayah scheduled. Chaz de Hashem, we've been busy for the last 5 weeks going to Levayahs. So now we're not going to Levayah. Go out. So therefore what? So now we're going to party? We're going to have music yet? Slip shot. So even in minute number one, it doesn't make, really, it would seem to be illogical. So either in minhag number one, we would also have to append the yahrzeit of Rav Shimon ben Yochai, or something else. There, I saw in one of the Achrayim, it escapes me. Maybe I have to go take out the blog from a few years ago and go back to it because I thought it was a chidah. quite sure, but I looked in all the Svarim of the Chidah that I could get my hands on, and I didn't find it. But the Chidah was a massive writer, so that's no raya, but I believe it was in the Chidah, but it doesn't, it could be a sort of a different Achron, but it wasn't. That, let's put ourselves in the shoes of Rabbi Akiva for a moment, and his generation. Rabbi Akiva lived in one of the darkest moments in the Jewish history. One of the darkest moments. He probably lived at a time which you probably have to go to Omar probably till 1945 to have a year that is as bleak. I don't know, maybe at the end of Tach B'Tat also, you know, in 1749, you know, perhaps we would, rather 1649, you know, at the end of the Chmelnytsky uprisings, so maybe it was also a similarly bleak moment, but I'm not sure that that moment was as bleak, I don't know. But certainly Rabbi Akiva's moment was as bleak as the moment of 1945. Here Rabbi Akiva was born 20 years into the Common Era, approximately. He dies approximately 140 in the Common Era, at the age of 120. So he lived 70 years of his life after the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash. So he witnesses the Churban of the Mikdash, the dispersal of the Jewish people, the tremendous bloodshed that takes place. 60 years after the Churban, Bar Kochba comes and he thinks, oh, the Yeshua is coming, that this is, you know, Mashiach Tzidkenu was on the way. And it doesn't work out that way. And there's a new bloodbath, Beitar is destroyed, and the land is really desolate after all of this. He lived in very, very hard times, Rabbi Akiva. So in the 100 years after Rabbi Akiva, is Rabbeinu HaKadosh. Rabbeinu HaKadosh, I always believed this to be the case, and I saw just over Shabbos, I saw what the Machzor Vitri on Pirkei Avos spells it out. Rabbeinu HaKadosh wrote the Mishnah. He used the confluence of a number of different events and circumstances to write the Mishnah. One is, this was 100 years since the Asura HaRugei Malchus. And this was the first moment Rabbeinu HaKadosh had very good ties with the Roman government. Right? And we find in Shas about Antoninus and Rabbi Akiva were very tight. So I always remember of Grumblat, the Rosh Shuvah, one of my Chaverim. I meant Rabbeinu HaKadosh. I meant Antoninus. I'm sorry. Rabbeinu HaKadosh wrote the Mishnah at very good ties with Antoninus. So Grumblat always mentioned that the historian said, who's? We didn't find an Antoninus among the emperors of Rome. Until one day in an archaeology dig, they found something, a shard that said Marcus Aurelius Antoninus. So the Roman emperor, known in history as Marcus Aurelius, had the third name, title, whatever it was, of Antoninus. And that was the colleague, who the one that had the collegial relationship with Rabbeinu HaKadosh. So he, externally, there was a time of tranquility. So he used that to gather Kol Chachma Yisrael, where they could sit and learn in peace and quiet for the first time probably in 200 years since the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash, and gather all the Torah, all the Messiah, from all the varied schools and assemble it in one place. He also obviously saw that tranquility is not the future lot of the Jewish people, unfortunately. And to have a Messiah which is based totally on Torah Shavar Peh is no way it could survive under those circumstances. If you have to learn everything Baal Peh, then you're very dependent on having organized learning and a Rebbe and circumstances which allow you to learn in that fashion. A Mishnayos is a phenomenal thing. You can run away and hide in the basement from your enemies and put on a little candle and a little bit of moonlight and you can learn. You don't need the Rebbe there if you don't have one, unfortunately. So he saw that, and he makes another point, Rashi, which he says was similarly shared by Rav Asher. Rav Asher probably similarly understood it 200 years after Rabbeinu HaKadosh what his circumstances were headed. He says both of them were rich men, Rabbeinu HaKadosh and Rav Asher. To undertake a monumental project to write the Mishnah, gather Kol Chachmei Yisrael, or gather Chachmei Yisrael and write the Shas, you have to be a person that has a lot of time to devote. a person that has to worry about economic matters can't be such a do-gooder. He says, Rabbi HaKadosh and Rabbi Ash were both wealthy men. So Parnassa wasn't their problem. So they were able to devote themselves to a larger public cause. One wrote the Mishnah and one wrote the Shas. So he seizes the moment. This is 100 years after Rabbi Akiva. We have war things at this point in time. They were so bad that Rabbi Chiya, the foremost disciple of Rabbeinu HaKadosh, spends his life, Shas tells us, running around starting elementary yeshivas to teach Chumash and Mishnayos. They didn't have elementary schools in Eretz Yisrael in the time of Rabbeinu HaKadosh to teach Chumash and Mishnayos. And this is what Shas says, G'day L'masachia, he accomplished unbelievable things for Klal Yisrael. So this is already, this is where the situation in Rabbi Akiva's time, the handwriting's on the wall. Things are on the way down, the circumstances are dire. All of a sudden there's a glimmer of hope. Rabbi Akiva, in the darkness of this Golos, Yavda v'chachamel flowers. There are 24,000 Talmidim in Rabbi Akiva. And I would suggest 24,000 plus Talmidim. We'll come to that in a moment. It looked like, dude, we're going to have a tremendous religious revival. 60, 70 years, 50 years after the Churban. We're on the way again. In 6 weeks, it all fell apart. They're all dead. This was a catastrophe. On top of all the other tragedies of these centuries, the glimmer of hope was also gone. And I think what the Gemara means, Vayoilam Shomim, Rabbi Akiva had other Talmidim. I don't think the Pshat is he only had these Talmidim. But what he lost 24,000 first-rate Talmidim that could bring light up the world with their Torah. Yeah, he had other Talmidim, but not of that rank. Atshavar Rabbi Akiva, Atzer Rabbi Sinner Shavadorim. Then he had five later superstar Talmidim. And those five later superstar Talmidim preserved the Torah. And that a link between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi HaKadosh of the Mishnah. You know, just as, you know, there are times, there are individuals that undertake things and they don't necessarily know in their own time what exactly the scope of their activity is really going to be, what it's going to affect. We had the same thing in our own century. I should say in the 20th century. We're in the 21st century now. But the author of Slobodka wanted very, very much to strengthen Torah Europe. And for that reason, he had a hand in building yeshivas all over Europe. And his perspective was that he needs very great people, because only very great people could really raise the banner of Torah. And he was extremely concerned about dealing with brilliant students. And he had brilliant students that were even dabbling in the Haskalah, and he kept around yeshiva. And a goodly number of them he managed to pull back and send in the right direction. Some of them became in the ranks of the Gedolei Hador. You know, so his intention, circa 1920, was to strengthen Torah Europe. The Rebbe Shlomo made, unbeknown to him and anyone, a little trick. And his superstar Talmidim of that era, a handful of them, arrived in this country. And most of the major yeshivas in this country were founded by the Talmidim of one particular era, circa 1920, in that era of the altar. It's just before he left Eretz Yisrael. His last kufa in Europe. Right? We have Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky came from there. Rav Ruderman and Eretz Yisrael came from there. Rav David Leibowitz came from there. Rav Yitzchak Kutner came from there. And Rav Aaron Kotler came from there. Not bad. Not a bad lineup to have in your yeshiva. You know, you can hold your head high. It'd be good for the fundraising. You know, Rav Isai, listen, you know, in the last door, this is the chevra we gave out, you know. Pretty impressive. Hey, if you have any one of them would be impressive. To have one kufa yeshiva where you came out with such luminaries, and that it's the backbone of the yeshivas in America. Came from one person, and one kufa. Rabbi Akiva was similar. To Purim, just to understand the perspective of his time. So what I saw in one of the Achronim was a very fascinating thing. That he wrote that when did the new yeshiva open? The new yeshiva also opened on Lag BaOmer. Not the Lag BaOmer when they stopped off. But ultimately, the new yeshiva opened on Lag BaOmer. The Hashgacha did very, very strange things. The Hashgacha, this was the day that Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai brought great Chiddush HaTorah to the world. And it became a day apparently slated for that. Later on, Doris later, Rabbi Akiva would light up the world with the Torah of Lag BaOmer. The new yeshiva opened with the Rav Asena Shabbadorim. That yeshiva opened on Lag BaOmer. And I believe, I speculate, but I believe the enactment of the Avelus Asfiras Omer was not contemporaneous with the demise of Rabbi Akiva. Remember, Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim died in the 2nd century. The Shas was closed in the 5th century. There are 300 years later between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ashi. If Chachmei HaShas wanted to enact a mourning period for these 24,000 superstars that died, they had 3 centuries to do so. So whatever the reasons, they chose not to. In the Gaonic period, they went back and they introduced mourning for the Talmidim Rabbi Akiva too. As we know, in the Kinnus of Tisha B'Av, a number of the Kinnus dealing with the events in Worms and Spire deal with the events which took place during this period of the Sfiras HaOmer, the beginning of Sivan and Chodesh Iyar. These were times of tremendous suffering in Europe at the time of the Crusades. And I guess they looked back and they saw that historically this was a time that was a tragic time for Klal Yisrael, and that we should mourn it. But when they enacted it, they did something else. They said, Rabbi Yisai, we've been here before. You know, one thing about a businessman that has been in business for a long time, one koyach he has is he's seen most problems that cyclically afflict this field, his endeavor. And when you ask him something, he tells you, yeah, I've been there before. It happened 20 years ago. It happened 40 years ago, you know. And this is what happened. This is the way it came out. So this is probably the way I'll deal with it. And whatever. And a couple of years from now, we'll look back that this was the third time that it happened. A seasoned businessman is not blown away. He's seen the problem before. He's dealt with it before. And they'll deal with it again. So Klal Yisrael said, Rabbi Yisrael, we're at a dark hour. The Yimach Shamam, the Crusaders, decided. Who wants to wait, you know, until they get to the Middle East to fight with the Muslim infidels? You know, we're on the way passing through Europe. I mean, we might as well kill the Jewish infidels while we're at it. And well, then we can rob them also while we're at it, loot. So this became a very, very difficult time for the Jewish people. They laid waste, you know, communities as they went. And this was a hard time for the Jews of the Middle East because of the wars there, and the Arabs were up in arms. This was not an easy time for the Jewish people. So what did they do? Well, they enacted the Sfiras, the earliest that I know of, I don't know, maybe historians have found it early. The earliest that I know of is that Ibn Shu'ab was a Rebbe of the Ramban. He reports that there were minhagim, you know, of Avelus and Sfiras. Now, Ibn Shu'ab is not usually in the Balei Halochas. Ibn Shu'ab is Droshes, Agodas, Parshonas, you know, but that area. But in one of his forum we find that a notation about the Minhagim of Avelus which had come forth. So our forefathers at that time, 1,000 years ago, said, Rabbi Yisai, we've been here before. It was mighty bleak in Rabbi Akiva's time. But Lag BaOmer is a day to celebrate. The Torah of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai burned brightly. Rabbi Akiva began his new endeavors on Lag BaOmer. And with that, he preserved the Torah. It's 1,000 years since Rabbi Akiva was still here with the Rabbeinu Shel Olam's Torah. So we've been in this place before. Not the first time in our history we've been here. And we managed, with Siyata Dishmaya, to get to move forward again. and rebuild. We're not out. So I think this is the notion that they were out to project when they came to Lag BaOmer. That we were at a very dark moment. It's true. But look what came forth from that moment. From that moment, Rabbi Akiva began again, and he succeeded. So the Shah says that the Torah was miskayim in that door because of Rabbi Akiva, because of those five Talmidim. It's also, so there's an object lesson at two levels. There's a historical object lesson, a communal object lesson, that we can succeed in the darkest of hours. There's a personal object lesson too. I would like to understand and be zoich a little bit to the personality of Rabbi Akiva. Could you imagine? Our Shiva comes, he had 24,000 superstars, and now he opens up a new yeshiva, and there are five guys there, five heavy hitters. You know, a normal human being would go into depression just to walk into the yeshiva. He'd start to cry and run out. Who could say shit? And yet Rabbi Akiva said, Babuk is Razarecho, Lerav Atanach Yodecho. Hoyelo Talmidim in his youth, so you should see that you have Talmidim as a Knusa in the older years too. And you don't know what you can accomplish. The chizuk that it took to do such a thing is awesome. But it's b'chol dor v'dor. They're Agdoli Yisrael that have that fire within them. Rav Aaron Kotler, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, came. He arrived in New York from San Francisco on the train to Grand Central Station. And Irving Bunim came to meet him. So he greeted him. And then he asked Irving Bunim, no, he says, where are we building the yeshiva? He immediately started meetings with yeshiva. Within a week, he was saying shir in Irving Bunim's house already and started to say shir. This is a year and a half on the run for his life, with the world behind him up in flames. But there was no time to catch his breath. There's a letter that I saw, you know, sometimes in the country, used to go to, it's another place, Lambi, but of an odd hours in White Lake, to Satmar had a small Vesmedrish there. Now they have a huge one in Monticello, but they had it in White Lake. So I used to go there sometimes to daven at odd hours. So I'm sitting there at the shul one day, and there's a sefer of letters of the Satmar Rebbe, Zatzal, the Rebbe of Yoel. So the letter is just awesome, this letter. Absolutely awesome. The letter was written, I think, the beginning of Topshin Zion, something like that, like 1946, 47, right when he came to the United States, apparently. And it was written, he had been, I think, in Chicago, raising money, and this was a letter that he wrote when he came back to the Rabbanim of Chicago to ask for that continued help. So there, he was, at that time in his life, he was past 60 years old already. And the world just went up in flames around him. So he's almost plaintive and apologetic. He says, no. He says, what Chazal said, that if you had Talmidim in your youth, and I had thousands of Talmidim in my youth, you should attempt to have Talmidim in your elder years. So Mameil, I'm undertaking this. He's like, plaintively almost apologizing for why he's, you know, undertaking this endeavor. And he writes the following. He says, I have 300 Talmidim in yeshiva, and I have another 300 Talmidim that want to come, but I don't have any room for them. I have no place for them yet, so I have to do something about it. He says, my situation is dire. He says, in Europe, in Satmar, he says, money was a non-issue to me. He said, I had wealthy industrialists that stood at my side, and whatever I needed, they funded, and money was a non-issue. Able to run the meistis and do what we had to for the kehila without difficulty, you know, it worked. And beyond that, he says, the parents of the Talmidim at yeshiva also sent some money to the yeshiva. So between the industrialists and the parents, everything worked. He says, unfortunately, the industrialists don't exist anymore. These kids are all Yisaimim. And here I am with 300 Talmidim and 301 knocking on the door. To look back 60 years later, just imagine what this one person starting off at such a bleak spot accomplished. This is the fire that Rabbi Akiva had. This is what they meant to connect with when they enacted the Sefiras HaOmer. Yeah, it's bleak. But in the darkness, we can light the light. We've done it before, and Be'ez Hashem, we will do it again. Yeah.
Could you clarify, at the beginning of this year, you were talking about day of the Yortzeit of Bar Yochai.
Oh, Shomer Ben Yochai, yeah.
And, you know, it became a very big thing in Eretz
Yisrael. Yeah, that's going on for Dairus. I mean,
but there are differences of opinion. I understand the Bris Hashanah.
The who? Well, listen, there was controversy about this for generations, if this should, if this is appropriate or not. Listen, but what are we, what? Yeah, yeah. There's, you know, we're dealing in a realm that we don't really understand. That's the problem. I will relate it to you in two ways. There's a Yid that I know, okay, he comes from the Karelitz family, from the Chazar Ish's family. He is from a family of hard-headed Litvaks, you know. You can't be further away from Chassidim than these guys. Hard-headed Litvaks all the way. He had a brother, somebody 10, 15 years ago about, who was 38 years old. A massive Talmud Chacham. And one day he just fell into a coma. Boom. For whatever reason, I don't know if they ever figured out why, he fell into a coma at the age of 38. He was in a coma in Eretz Yisrael for, I don't know, two and a half years. Then they thought there was some hospital here in the United States, maybe that could save his life. So they got a special air ambulance and they brought him in. He was here a while and he died. About a half a year after he dies, he said, the brother that I know tells me this ma'isa. He says, my brother came either to him or to his brother or both of them. I don't recall, I think to both of them, one night. And he told him the following. He said, I bought a piece of jewelry in Borough Park for my wife, coming back from one of the times that I was abroad. And I left $80 unpaid. And just the way, I guess he got ill, whatever, he never returned. So I'm asking you, when he described approximately how the place looked, where, you know, what it was, to go take care of this place. So I asked him, why are you coming now? Because he died 6 months ago. So he says, until now they didn't make any inyan about it. But now I'm supposed to go to a higher level in Gan Eden. And until this inyan is masudar, is straightened out, I can't go. So they went, according to that, you know, the description was on some block on 13th Avenue, they went. There was a jewelry store there. They went and a firm lady owns it. And she mished through her bills. And she found, yeah, there's a bill, a guy bought a piece of jewelry, whatever he paid. And they left $80 unpaid. You know, fished it out. Here's the wallet. Here it is. He had a date when it was. They examined his travel logs, and sure enough, he was in the United States. He was in New York that week. Okay, this is a ma'isa of hard-headed litvakas. This is Lishke Chassidish ma'isa. So that's one Indian. That's why we don't understand exactly. We don't know what the spheres of Gan Eden and what happens in the Yortzeit exactly. These are realms that are very, very hidden from us. I will also tell you something else that I know. And this I also heard from a hard-headed Litvak. He lives today in Harnof. He's in his mid-80s. He's a Talmud El Chazanish. I know him for many, many years. And yeah, some of this room, in this room, are old enough to remember the Six-Day War. There are some people there that can remember the Six-Day War. Now, if you remember, after the Six-Day War, there was a huge commotion that there was some Sfardi Mekubel, I think Yankel was his name, Yaakov, something like that, and he left a letter that there was going to be a big war in Eretz Yisrael, and there was a huge Nitzachon for the Jewish people, if you recall, right after the waters came out. The story is true. This Talmud of the Chazon Ish that I know, he was somehow, by marriage, I don't know, he was related to him. He was a korov of his. And this Sfarad HaShe'ir, he was a Bal Malocha, I believe. But he was a very, very holy man. And people would come to him to be mispalo. He would never tell a person, you're going to get better, unless the person was going to get better. He would say, well, daven this and that. But the family knew, his hanhogas. He understood which people were going to get better and which people wouldn't get better. Which ones, the tefillahs could help for, which they couldn't. But daven, but he would never tell a person you're going to get better. If he told them they were going to get better, the guy got better. A man came to him once to be mispalel, his son was sick and he left. He told his family he doesn't know he needs the tefillahs more than his son needs the tefillahs. So this Talmud of the Chazon Ish had his first child was born unhealthy, his first son. And the child's life was in danger, so he went to this korov of his and he asked him to be the sandik by the bris of this child. And he wouldn't say that he would be sandik. So finally bothered him, and he understood what the implications of that. He knew it was hanhogas. So he bothered him. So finally this Mekubal said to him, I'll be the sandik at the bris of a son of yours. And kachoya. His first child died. And this Mekubal lived, and later he was the sandik by one of his sons. Rosh Chodesh El, Tovshin Chavov, okay, 1966. This Mekubal went to Meron to be mispalo at the Tzion of Rav Shimon ben Yochai. Comes back from the Tzion, and he tells his family that he saw a simon at the Tzion today, that this coming year he's leaving the world. And Kachal, he died in Cheshvan, Tovshin Chav Zayin. And he's the one that left this letter. Okay, so you're dealing with things, your Zeiten that we don't understand, and we're dealing with a place that we don't understand. You know. Ich weiß nicht, what a Mekubal saw. I have no idea. Ich bin nicht kein Mekubal. I don't know about these things. But the Yid was for real. So.
This has come up before. Those 24,000 Talmidim, wouldn't you think A, Rabbi Akiva would have davened for them and usually when he davened, you know, his tefillahs were listened to. B, since we know why they died, wouldn't he have exhorted them to do tshuva? And probably they did if he told them to, so.
Well, probably it happened too fast for anyone to figure out what happened. That's what I estimate took place. And yeah, I'm sure he davened for them. I say all the time, you know, that I've said this many times. If Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim had lived, how much Torah would we have from them? Massive amounts. Right? So multiply 5 Talmidim by 5,000, a factor of 5,000. Okay, so you get some idea of the amount of Torah quantitatively that we would have. I don't know if anyone would ever finish Shas with the Daf Yomi on that basis. I don't know if it would happen. Yet the Rabbeinu Shel Olam was machriya that that Torah should disappear from the world. And we should have the Torah of 5 Talmidim. So what does that tell us? That tells us that Torah, which is rooted in the shlemus of the person, a person who's been on the Moko, who's been on the Chavero, is correct, that's a Torah that will endure and will inspire Klal Yisrael, who will survive the Golus. A Torah which is in the heart of a flawed person, that Torah will ultimately not succeed. And Rabbi Yehuda Klal Yisrael, the Rebbe Shlomo, said, we can scotch that. That's not going to help us here. That's really the message. And that, I think, was the message of Rabbi Akiva altogether. We know that there's a machlekes ben Azai in Rabbi Akiva. It's in the Toras Kayanim. Right? Rabbi Akiva said, "What's the klal gadol b'Torah?" The klal gadol b'Torah is v'ahavta l'rayacha kamayacha. Ben Azai wasn't impressed. Ben Azai says, "I'll tell you a klal which is greater than your klal." B'tzelem alokim bora yisai. The Rebbeinu Shem created men with Tzelem Elokim. So the Malbim explains, why does the principle of Ben Azai transcend that of Rabbi Akiva? Because based on Rabbi Akiva's principle of after the Reyach HaKamocha means whatever I have feeling for, I should worry about it for you too. And I like to dress well, so I should see that you also have the chance to dress well. I like a nice house, I should want you to have a nice house. You know, I've known people, and I'm sure you have, there are people that certain things in life don't mean anything to them. You know, there are people, food doesn't mean a thing to them. Just doesn't mean anything to them. You know, they eat because you have to eat, because otherwise you'll die. But that's, you know, it's like what I joke, when I joke with people, I said, listen, you come to my house, I'll give you a good scotch, but you have to tell me one thing, that you're a maven. If you're not a maven, it's baltashchus, you know. So what's the point, you know? It's mamish baltashchus. If you appreciate it, I have no problem. There are people that have no hasogus in food. Food doesn't mean a thing to them. You got to eat because, you know, that's the way it is. Otherwise, you'll peter out. So a steak, a piece of chicken, a tuna, it's all, you know. 5 minutes after they ate, you wouldn't know what they ate. Based on Rabbi Akiva's principle of after Reyach HaKamoicha, if I'm such a type of person, so I wouldn't have to worry that you should eat steak for dinner. It doesn't, you know, whatever is important to me, so have the same feeling for the next guy. This doesn't register on my scale of value, so, okay, potter. Then as I said, forget what's important to you. It's not where it's at. B'tzelem Elokim bara yisrael. Man is a tzelem Elokim. He reflects divinity. Right? What did Rashi tell us in Dvarim? Ki kilulas Elokim toloi. Right? Lo sona nivlosei alaitz. If you degrade a human being, you're degrading the Shekhinah. If you understand you're dealing with the Shekhinah, so what wouldn't you do for the Shekhinah? Right? Well, for myself, I don't care. What wouldn't I do for the Shekhinah? For the Rebbeinu Shalom. This human being is the Rebbeinu Shalom's child. It's B'Tzelem Elokim. So what shouldn't I do for him? This was the teaching of Ben Azai. So I've always believed that Rabbi Akiva taught V'Ahavta L'Rayach HaKamocha, not in the exclusion of Ben Azai's, but why it became his theme, was after he lost the first 24,000 Talmidim. And the Shas tells us, why shall Lenogu Kovod Zebuzah? They didn't have the right respect for each other. So what did he preach after that? He said, Rabbi Isai, when he had the Rabbi Senu Shabador. Oh, Rabbi Isai, we used to have a huge yeshiva with 24,000 guys. We have a yeshiva with 5 today. You know why? Because they didn't fulfill V'Ahavta L'Rayach HaKamocha the right way. You can imagine the fire in that drosha. So this is Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva preached Shleimus HaTorah. The great Rabbi Akiva, whose ability in the Torah Sheval Peh, Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't fathom the ability of Rabbi Akiva in the Torah Sheval Peh. Right? That's what the Gemara tells us in Menachos. But he asked, what are the Tagim? He's going to come, Rabbi Akiva, he had Chalishas Hadas, but he told him, listen, everything comes from Torah's Moshe, so don't, you know, ultimately it's all tied back to you. But the Koyach of Rabbi Akiva and Torah Shabbat Peh was unfathomable. And yet, what did he preach? He said, Rabbi Yisrael, it's all going to Shabbat. Nothing's going to come of it unless we hook it together with V'Ahavta L'Rayach HaKamocha. This was, so we know now what the basic program of Rabbi Akiva's second yeshiva was. Right? They taught two things there. You learn Shas under the master Talmudist Rabbi Akiva, and at the same time he taught you the basics in Berodun Chaverot, what you have to do. Segeitnisht. Without this, we're not going anywhere. So the yeshiva is gone before we start if we don't have this. So this became the major teaching of Rabbi Akiva in life. For haftal reyacha kamoicha. So these are the things that we need to, you know, think about when it comes to Lag BaOmer, the nitzchis of Klal Yisrael. Makes no sense. No sense at all. The nitzchis of Klal Yisrael. It's mentioned on other occasions. The Yaivitz writes in his Akdomo to the Siddur. It's near the beginning. It's a very lengthy Akdomo. So if you want to find it at Siddur Yaivitz, you have to know to look near the beginning. It's one of the first few pages. It's a very, very lengthy Akdomo to the Siddur. So he says, if we wish to see Nisim, which transcend the Nisim, which are greater than the Nisim of Bitzias Mitzrayim, study the survival of Klal Yisrael and Golus. The Nisim that are inherent in that surpass the Nisim of Yitzias Mitzrayim. And I think we could say that the survival of the Rabbeinu Shel Olam's Torah is even a bigger nest than this physical survival of the Jewish people. How we maintained the Rabbeinu Shel Olam's Torah over all the generations, despite all the difficulties that we had. It defies all logic. It defies all logic. And yet the Rabbeinu Shel Olam provided for that too. So I think this is the connection. When we think back in Lag BaOmer, the rebirth of Rabbi Akiva, and the darkest hours is what to celebrate. Because the Rabbeinu Shel Olam is with us. And somehow the darkness will disperse. And we'll see light. Some days it's hard to believe we're going to see the light. But history has taught us that we will. That the darkness will pass. And I think this was the ultimate lesson. That's why we celebrate on Lag BaOmer, the Nitzchias of Klal Yisrael. Good night, Rabbi Yisrael.